This is Mark, the podcast producer. Just a quick note before this episode starts. This was originally going to be one episode to celebrate the arrival of Colossus 80 years ago this month. Now, David and Tom like to go into detail, and we wanted to really do justice to this subject. So instead of one episode, we're splitting this into two parts. This first part looks at the background to why Colossus had to be built in the first place, and part two will pick up the story from there. Now over to the show.
From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the January 2024 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Colossus in context. 80 years ago, in January 1944, the first Colossus computer was delivered to Bletchley Park. This machine and the nine that followed it have acquired legendary status within the story of World War II codebreaking. The machines have also been described as the world's first large-scale electronic digital computers, direct precursors of the digital world in which we live today. But in 1944, the computer age still lay far in the future. These machines were built for a specific and vital purpose, to assist with the breaking of the wireless messages of Germany's senior commanders, enciphered using the Lorenz cipher machine, and known at BP as Tunny. What role did Colossus actually play in the breaking of Tunny? The Colossus machines were members of a wider family of machines, and the Numenery, the department in which they operated, was only one of several teams at Bletchley Park, all of whom were crucial to the successful breaking of the cipher. In this It Happened Here episode, Bletchley Park historians Dr. Thomas Cheatham and Dr. David Kenyon are here to place Colossus in context, and examine where exactly these machines fitted into the effort to break Tunny.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
In this It Happened Here episode, we're commemorating the 80th anniversary of the arrival of the first Colossus machine here at Bletchley Park. In this episode, though, we want to do what we normally do, which is look in detail at Colossus, and not just Colossus, but why we had Colossus. So first off, David, there's lots of acronyms and code words that sort of revolve around Colossus. I'm thinking things like Fish and Tunny and Lorenz and Sturgeon, Colossus itself. Can you clarify some of these? And do we need all of these in this episode?
We probably need most of them, but they are a tricky one because a lot of them are used relatively inexactly, even during the war. When these terms are bandied about at the time, their meanings are different to different people. It's like when we talk about Ultra. What does Ultra actually mean?
Yeah.
Nailing that one down, it's a bit like kind of trying to nail a jelly to a wall. It's exactly what it means. It's tricky. At heart, though, all of the machines and processes we're going to talk about today stem from the Bletchley Park effort to break a particular set of German codes. All of these codes work on wireless. Some of them were used on landlines as well, but we discussed before how landlines are very difficult to intercept because you have to actually tap the line, whereas wireless, it's broadcast, so you can pick it up in the UK or wherever. So we're talking about codes and ciphers used with wireless transmissions. Normally, when we talk about Enigma or other similar systems, we're talking about Morse code and the idea of a person with a hand tapper sending out letters one by one. Today, we're talking about teleprinter systems, teleprinter ciphers. We've talked a lot about teleprinters in the podcast in the past because military communications in the UK and Bletchley Park's communications relied very heavily on teleprinters. And teleprinters, for those who haven't heard us describe them before, it's basically, if you get a typewriter and you plug a wire into it and you plug a typewriter into the other end of the wire, when you type on one typewriter, the text comes out on the paper roll on the other one.
And they're connected via telephone line.
Connected by a telephone line. That's what teleprinters normally do. However, you can also connect teleprinters together by wireless. You can take the electronic output from the teleprinter machine, plug it into a radio transmitter, and send it over the airwaves and have it received at the other end and plugged into another teleprinter. So you can do the same thing. The difference is when you send a Morse signal, typically that signal is either signal or silence. It's kind of on or off. So you get a beep and then you get silence and then you get another beep. Teleprinter signals, by contrast, tend to be two different tones of signal. So it's like a warble. It's a kind of high note, low note, high note, low note. The German military, in addition to using Enigma and other machine and hand cipher systems, have a teleprinter network. I call it network advisedly. We'll get to that later. They have a teleprinter communication system, which is used by the highest echelons of their military. So you're talking army and army group level commanders who are the most senior commanders in each theater. So von Rundstedt in Paris in 1944, or Army Group South, Army Group Center in Russia, or Kesselring in Italy, people like that, communicating with Berlin. And there is a network for those people that allows them to talk to one another over these what are called teleprinter links. And they're called links because if you look at the use of Enigma, for example, quite often the Germans will have a whole series of radio stations who are all communicating with one another, and messages are often transmitted to more than one recipient. How the teleprinter system works is they have individual place-to-place links. So there will be a transmitter in Berlin talking to a transmitter in Paris and back again, and a separate one talking to Rome or
It's just one
Thessalon.
Either end.
One either end. And that was what would be known as a FISH link. FISH being the overall cover term that Bletchley Park gives to all of these teleprinter transmission systems. There's more than one cipher machine being used on these FISH links. The one we're going to talk about today in particular is a machine called the Schlüsselzusatz 42, SZ42, a Schlüsselzusatz being a cipher attachment. And what that basically means is it's a machine that you plug into your teleprinter to make it an enciphered teleprinter. There are various models of this machine manufactured by the Lorenz company. Pre-war, they make teleprinters, so they're the ideal people to make the cipher adapter for the teleprinter. And they also make wireless sets. So the Lorenz Schlüsselzusatz 42 is the machine we're mostly going to talk about. There's some confusion because there's a SZ38, there's an SZ40, and there's an SZ42, but exactly which nomenclature applies to which machine is a bit hazy even now, because only a small number of machines were captured at the end of the war, and exactly which terms relate to which machines is tricky, but they all do basically the same things. Exactly which one we're talking about doesn't matter very much. Within the FISH sort of umbrella, all of these Lorenz machines were given the sub code name, if you like, Tunny. Tunny as in tuna fish. But there's another machine which the German Navy used, which they refer to as Sturgeon. Sturgeon is manufactured by Siemens and Halske. Siemens T-52 is Sturgeon. That's used by the German Navy. But it's not used very much. And so it's never really a big priority for Bletchley Park. So although there are other machines and other things going on within FISH, most of what Bletchley Park is interested in FISH and most of the work that they concentrate on is on these Lorenz machines. And so technically, we're talking about specifically the Tunny machine, as it's called, but it equally gets referred to as FISH. And a lot of the contemporary documents also call it FISH, because although FISH technically encompasses these other systems, if you're not breaking those other systems, they're not really relevant to the story. The problem is worsened by the fact that one of the machines we'll be talking about, which is manufactured for Bletchley Park and called Tunny, is a machine which is basically an electronic replica of the cipher machine itself. So when they talk about a Tunny machine, they might be referring to a German SZ42 as a Tunny machine, or they might be talking about the specific British analogue of that machine, which was also known as Tunny, or they might be talking about the whole system and referring to it as Tunny. So
just to make it nice and easy.
These things are never straightforward. Regular listeners will know that the complexities and the, I suppose you could almost call it the inexactitude of how, what is basically office slang is applied to this stuff, because there isn't a formal book of Bletchley Park code names. They just allocated names to things that made it convenient for them to do their work and to keep things secret. So, you know, probably at the time, these words were bandied about by different people in different ways. The other key feature of FISH traffic, as it's called, is it's sent using this teleprinter signal rather than a Morse code signal. and it's generated automatically by the cipher machine. When you type on the teleprinter, the encryption happens electronically. And what that means is you can send much longer messages. Enigma messages were typically limited to 250 characters. They have to be encrypted a letter at a time by hand by pressing the buttons on the Enigma machine.
You need three people to do it.
Yeah, and then sending the Morse code at hand speed. Whereas a Lorenz message, you can either type away on the keyboard at normal typing speed and it's transmitted more or less instantaneously at the speed you type, or you can pre-record the message onto paper tape. We'll come to the paper tape later because part of how the cipher works is based on how the paper tape works. And you could record it onto this paper tape, and then you would feed the paper tape with the message already punched into it into the machine, and then it would just read the whole tape in one go and transmit it seamlessly to the other end. In terms of the code names, where we came in on this, Bletchley Park identifies individual links, these paired places that have a fish connection between them, a tunny connection between them. And each of those is given a separate code name. The first one they identify between Athens and Vienna is referred to as Tunny, but then each one after that is given another fishy name. So you have Bream is the connection between Berlin and Rome and Kesselring. Jellyfish is the connection to France. They use about 50 different fish by the end of the process. Some of the fish are fish I've never heard of. I was going through them going, is that really a fish?
Well, they were running out.
They were running out of code names. So you get all these different links, all with these different names. The other thing that's often said about these links, which is a myth that we should perhaps scotch fairly early on, is if you read short versions of the story of Lorenz and Colossus, they talk about messages from Adolf Hitler himself. Theoretically, if Hitler wanted to send a message to von Rundstedt, he could send it on a fish link. But that's not typically what's going on. Yes, the messages are going from German high command. There is a link to the Wolf's Lair in Rastenburg. There's links to the OKW headquarters in Berlin. So people are talking at the highest level. It's not Hitler's email box, inbox, you know, he's not writing the messages himself.
It's going to be OKW or OKH,
it's going to be people who are close to the high command communicating on senior leaders' behalf. So yes, it's very, very important. But the idea that you're reading Hitler's messages, you're not really.
Well, it's shorthand, isn't it, for the story?
It's a shorthand. I mean, it's a minor point, but it's starters we mean to go on and get these things
right. Well, we do like
right,
to bust myths, don't we?
We like to nitpick on this podcast. So yes, what you have to think about is by the end of the war, a series of 50-plus two-station links, all carrying teleprinter traffic of long messages, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 character messages, 10,000 character messages. Think of a long email or an essay as opposed to an Enigma message, which might be considered a tweet.
Now, we know that they have Enigma at the start of the war. They go into the war with Enigma. When does Lorenz start being used? Is it already being used or does it come in during the war?
It's first picked up in the second half of 1940, but the Germans are only using it experimentally at that stage. They're trying to figure out how to make it work. And by the middle of 1941, it's being used fairly regularly, as I say, in these experimental stations in Athens and Vienna. It's not until the autumn of 1942 that it really starts being distributed across all the German theatres of war. So there's a good probably 2 years when it's experimental and fairly limited in its use. But then once it gets going in quite a big way. And there are huge numbers of messages being transmitted. So it gives Bletchley Park a huge amount to work on once it's mature as a system.
We know that Enigma works on this system of rotors with wires in, and the signal goes through these different rotors, and it goes through the plug board, and it comes out on the lamp board. How does Lorenz work? How does it differ? How does it work in comparison?
It works in an almost completely different way. The system on which it relies is a thing called Baudot code, Baudot code, or Baudot-Murray code. And this was invented by Emil Baudot in 1874. Morse had been invented, and he was looking at Morse, and he was going, is there another way to transmit alphabetical information, to write messages, other than Morse code? And he came up with his Baudot code. And how this works is each alphabetical character is expressed as, typically represented as dots or crosses. It's basically a binary number. And the way to think about it is, if you imagine your hand, including your thumb, you've got five digits, If you clench your fist, you've got no digits sticking out. You can stick out any one digit or combination of digits and create different patterns. You'll find if you work through all of them that there are 32 possible combinations of fingers that you can stick out, going from none at all to all five. So if you think about them as binary numbers, you can basically count to 32 on the fingers of one hand, 32 different possibilities. And on a piece of Baudot code, typically paper tape, that is represented by a row of five positions on the tape, sort of horizontally across the tape, which are either a punched hole or solid paper. So you get five positions where there's either a hole or not a hole. And by using all 32 possibilities, you can allocate all of those to the letters of the alphabet. And what they actually do is they allocate 30 of the 32 letters to the letters of the alphabet and other useful symbols. And they use two of them as a shift key, an upshift and a downshift, essentially.
Oh, right.
And that gives you another 32 keys because you can then use all the other 30 for something else. So you have a total of 62 possible characters. So you can have all the letters of the alphabet. You can have numerical characters.
Oh,
you
right.
can have punctuation marks. You know, a whole range of different stuff. But they're all produced by basically the first 32. So if you wanted to send the figure 1, for example, you would have to press shift and then the equivalent key for 1, which I think is Q, as I remember. And then you'd have to press the downshift key to go back to alphabetical again.
Oh, right. Okay.
And similarly, if you want to put in a full stop, you'd press shift up, full stop, shift down, carry on. This becomes important later because one of the things it does is it produces very distinctive groups of letters because the key that represents space is normally depicted as number 9 in the lower case, the unshifted alphabet. Quite often you'll see space, upshift, digit, downshift, space. So you get 9, 8, number, whatever it is, 7, I think, 9 again. So you get these patterns. And how this would work on a telephone or wireless system is the instrument we set up that it sends a particular signal that tells the machine at the other end that it's the start of a character, then it makes 5 beeps, you know, either high or low tone beeps, to give you the components of the letter, and then it gives you a little note again to tell you it's the end of that letter, and then it does the next one. So transmitted on cable or wireless, this would appear as a sequential series of a cross, which is equivalent to a hole in the paper tape, or a dot, which is equivalent to not a hole in the paper tape. But what's interesting about this system was it became very commonplace in teleprinting. People were using teleprinters all over the world. But how do you encipher it if you wish to encipher it, either for cable security or if you want to send it by wireless? So how do you encrypt it? And this is where a man by the name of Gilbert Sanford Vernon came in at the early part of the 20th century. And he, in 1918, was working for AT&T, the American telephone people. And he figured out that if you take two of these 5 position characters, this binary number almost, and add them together, and you say, right, a dot equals a cross equals a dot and a cross equals a cross, or a cross and a dot equals a cross. Those are your 5 options for adding them together. If you add them together in that way, you produce a 5 position character, which is a different letter. So this won't be exactly right, but you can take A and J and add them together and you'd get P or whatever. You can actually construct a table, and this was done at Bletchley Park, where you have all the alphabet across the top and all the alphabet down the side, and in the boxes in the middle, you have what those two letters add up to if you add them together. And what Gilbert Vernon figured out was if you took all of the letters of your plain text, of your message that you wanted to send somebody, and then you took a string of random letters the same length as your message, and you added each pair of letters together, you'd get a string of gobbledygook that was enciphered. And then all you had to do was send that to the person who wanted to receive the message, and they would get the same string of random characters. And what's clever about how the maths works is if you add that on again, it essentially cancels itself out. Because if you add either a plus to a plus or a cross or a dot together, you get a dot, which cancels itself out. The problem then arises, how do you tell the person at the other end what the string of random letters is that you have to add on? Because it has to be the same length as the message or longer. And it has to be unique. You can't keep using the same one over and over again. And this is where, for a long time, Vernam ciphers kind of fall down. Because the problem is, how do you generate what's called the key string, the random line of letters? Yeah. And people come up with all sorts of different versions of this. People use different tape-based machines. And One person comes up with the option of using two tapes, one of which is 1,000 characters long and one of which is 999 characters long, and then adding both of them so you get an even longer string. None of these really work. And it's only in 1930 this other chap comes along, Parker Hitt, who works for a different communication company called the International Telephone and Telegraph Company, ITT. Parker Hitt, in 1932, develops a device to solve this key problem, how to generate this string of random letters. And he does it by using wheels. And this is where the vague association with Enigma and sometimes the confusion with Enigma comes. What he suggests is if you get five wheels, rotors, each of your wheels then has pins on it, which are randomly distributed around the wheel, and they either add across or don't add across to the letter in each position. The wheels are different lengths relative to each other. They're all prime numbers relative to each other. And what this means is as the wheels rotate, they generate random characters because there may or may not be a pin active on each wheel in each position. And the period of it, the number of letters it generates before it repeats, is very, very long because all of the wheels are prime numbers relative to each other. And this is a great way of solving the problem. And what he does in addition is he says, well, let's not just do it once, let's do it twice. Let's have two sets of wheels in the machine. So you add on a randomly generated letter, but then you add on a second randomly generated letter that makes it even more secure. So even if someone could work out the very, very long pattern that your wheels were generating, they would still be flummoxed by the fact that there's a second very, very long pattern in there as well. And that's the Parker Hitt machine. Not many of them are made. He doesn't really make any money, but the idea is out there. The interesting part is that Lorentz in Germany, who are making these teleprinter machines and go on to make the SZ42, are a wholly owned subsidiary of ITT. So when the Germans are looking for a system to encipher teleprinter traffic, be it on cable or on wireless, Lorentz hold the Parker Hitt patents. They know how to build a machine that works on this principle. And what they build is initially the SZ38 and then the SZ40 and 42 that work on Parker Hitt's principle. And these are the Lorentz machines that we're going to be talking about. The additional complexity that they add to them is instead of just using 10 wheels, they use 12. And they put two wheels in the middle. And what those wheels do is they decide whether or not the second set of wheels should move or not. So you have one set of wheels which is changing every character of the message, and you have another set of wheels that is stuttering, which is sometimes moving and sometimes not moving. And they thought this added security to the system. We'll discover later on that actually it doesn't. It massively reduces the security of the system. This is a story we've heard with German cryptology many times, that they introduce things that think make them cleverer but actually make the systems worse. And there's a third aspect to the security of the machine, which is that all of these wheels, these 12 wheels in the machine, the little pins that stick out of them to generate the characters are adjustable. You can either switch them on or off. So each wheel, you can change what influence it's having as it goes around by switching the pins on or off. This has to be done quite carefully because if you don't switch the right number of pins on and the right number of pins off, you can sort of simplify the cipher. Obviously, if you switch them all off, you'd never do anything. It would never change anything, so it would be rubbish. So you have these multiple wheels with changeable pins, two sets of them, and wheels in the middle determining when the second set move. The only thing you don't get in a Lorentz machine, which, again, to make the analogy with Enigma, the only thing you don't get is you can't take the wheels out and swap them over. They always stay in the same position in the machine. Both sets of wheels have diminishing number of pins on them, working from left to right across your five positions in the character. On the first set of wheels, you've got wheels with lengths of 41, 31, 29, 26, and 23. And then on the second set, you've got 43, 47, 51, 53, and 59. So they're actually going up, they're going the other way. You can't swap those wheels over, but what you can do is you can reposition the pins on them. So if you're in the position of Bletchley Park, trying to understand this code, there are basically three things you need to do. The first thing you need to do is understand how the machine works in the first place. Yeah. So you have to create an understanding of how the machine functions to create the code. A lot of people will tell you that this was worked out by Bletchley Park just by sort of pure logic and mathematics and looking at the message traffic. My personal view is that given that a very, very similar machine was patented in the United States in 1932, the idea of how to do this would have been out there to any respectable cryptological organization. So it's quite possible that Bletchley Park were aware of the Parker Hitt patents and that if you wanted to create a Vernam cipher, that using these kind of wheels was one of the ways to do it. What they didn't know is exactly how the Germans had gone about it. But then if you intercept a particular message, there are two specific pieces of information you need to know. The first is, how are the pins arranged on all 12 wheels? In the early days, these are changed either monthly or three-monthly. So if you can work out the pins on the wheels, it gives you an edge for a reasonable amount of time. Later on in the war, they go to daily pin changes, which makes it really difficult. The second thing, which is sort of similar to Enigma, is you need to know the starting position of each wheel, where it is in its sequence of pins when the message starts. Firstly, you need to know how the pins are arranged on the wheels. And this was known as wheel braking at Bletchley Park. You have to brake the wheel. You have to understand where the pins are. And then the second thing you have to do is wheel setting. You have to know what the starting position of each wheel is. So if you brake the wheels, that can be useful to you for however long those wheels stay working, which could be a month early on. But for the wheel setting, you need to do that for every single message. As is so often in this podcast, we've got to the point where we say, and this sounds like a pretty brilliant cipher and pretty indestructible. So far, it sounds pretty good, doesn't it? But as always, that counts without the great brains that are here at Bletchley.
We'll turn to you, Tom, at this point. How did GC&CS first identify the traffic? Because this is completely different sounding radio signals, isn't it?
Absolutely. So the first element we have to deal with when we're trying to contextualize Colossus, before we even get on to talking about crypto, is interception. Because of course, as we all know, interception underpins everything Bletchley Park does. You need the traffic to be high quality and accurate so crypto analysts can work on it. And with fish traffic, that's no mean feat. But we also come here onto our second myth of the episode, which is a phrase that you'll see in many of the books that often comes up when people talk about Lorenz, which is new music.
Yes.
This idea that these transmissions appear in the ether and intercept operators in the UK pick them up and go, oh, what's this? I've never heard anything like this before. And they have no idea what it is. But again, for exactly the same reasons that we think the GC&CS cryptanalysts probably had a pretty good idea about the Parker hit machine and about how you would build such a machine, they also know about what they call non-Morse communication. What we refer to as radio teletype had been in use around the world for many years by that point, mostly in the United States, which is why we use the American term for it, teletype. Britain doesn't use a lot of radio teletype, and it's pretty new for the Germans as well. But there are certainly people in Britain who know what that technology is. We're not using it because we seem to rely more on high-speed Morse, which is a similarly fast system based, again, on paper tape, and it fulfills largely the same role, and it just seems the culture in Britain is more focused on high-speed Morse
than radio teletype.
But they certainly know what it is, and they have an awareness it's going to be out there, because even before the war, there are sort of committees put together to do investigations into what they call noise. And later on, they start to refer to it more as non-Morse. But noise is a term you see bandied around a lot as well. Apparently, the first noise transmissions that are picked up by the wire services are actually in 1932. So it's been around for many years. Lorenz is simply the first system that is picked up in Britain, which is of sufficient interest to really be attacked on a large scale and intercepted on a large scale. The driver of all these investigations into how you intercept this traffic is a man called Harold Kenworthy. And he's basically the Foreign Office's wireless expert before the war. And notably, he's behind setting up the intercept station at Denmark Hill, which is the Metropolitan Police intercept station. That's set up in the 1930s, basically as a way for the Foreign Office to do interception without having to pay for it by giving it this cover of being police activity. But by the time war breaks out, it has been transferred over to Foreign Office control and it's funded by the Foreign Office. And so that's the part of the Y services which deals with this problem initially. And there's work during 1940 and 1941 at Denmark Hill in London and also at RAF and Royal Naval Y stations on the South Coast in Kent. What's really valuable for the British in this period is that they are able to learn how the system works at the same pace as the Germans.
Oh, right.
Because it's all new to the Germans as well. And David talked about how this is a 2-year testing period before it becomes operational. Because the Germans don't know how to do radio teletype reliably either. They've got no experience of it. And it's a really tricky technical problem. The thing about teleprinter code is there's not a lot of redundancy in the signal. You send 5 units, which are dots or crosses. And if any one of those 5 units doesn't reach the receiving teleprinter, you'll get a different letter. You'll get corrupt traffic. And that's not such a problem when you're dealing with landlines, which are reliable, but when you're dealing with radio, the potential for interference is very, very high.
Yeah.
And so the Germans are having big problems with that. And the British are having big problems detecting what the Germans are sending, because the British are having to work out what kit is actually producing these signals, and then work out what they have on their side of the channel, which is capable of picking up these signals reliably.
Right, okay.
There are enormous technical complexities in getting the right pieces of equipment in place. A machine they rely on a lot, the British early on, is one called an undulator. And an undulator kind of does what it says on the tin, it undulates. When it picks up a signal, it has a needle and it goes up and down based on whether the signal is on or off. And you get a wavy line on a tape. And the peaks in that line correspond to when your teleprinter signal is turned on, when you're sending across. And therefore, you have a way of recording this traffic in a physical form, which can be filed away, referred to later, and is more robust than trying to get a teleprinter to interpret it, because it can deal with interference. So they're mostly using undulators to record this traffic on tape as a wavy ink line in the beginning. But again, they're helped by the Germans, because the Germans aren't using teleprinters either. They're using another machine, which they have in their arsenal of communications equipment, and it's called a Hellschreiber. And a Hellschreiber is a really neat bit of kit, which is somewhere between a teleprinter and a fax machine. What a Hellschreiber does, it doesn't work with a code of any sort, like Baudot-Murray code. It doesn't recognize a character in that way. When you send a letter on the Hellschreiber, what it does is send an image of that letter. And the machine inside it has a sort of drum with conductive patches on it, which kind of draw out a letter if you draw them out as rows. So when you press the letter A, for example, the machine will scan the part of the drum which relates to the letter A, and it will send a series of on-off pulses. The Hellschreiber at the receiving end will draw out that letter in a box, sort of as pixels. What you're sending effectively is what we nowadays refer to as a bitmap image of the letter. And what's really useful about this system is there's enormous redundancy in the signal. Each letter is actually broken down to 84 different signals. So you can lose half of a letter, and because it's printed physically on a piece of tape which comes out of the receiving machine, a human being can still read it. If you imagine you draw a letter A, but you kind of leave half the letter off, you can still work out that it's an A. And the machine doesn't need to know what letter it's being sent to draw a pretty good approximation of the letter it's being sent. And because of interference, you can never get the wrong letter. At worst, you'll get nothing. Whereas a teleprinter can print all sorts of nonsense thanks to interference. So the Hellschreiber is a really good compromise solution for the Germans when they're trying to get their radio links working more reliably. They can communicate to each other. They can say, tweak this at your end, try this and try that, until they get the signal strong enough and reliable enough that they can actually connect their teleprinters and send 5-unit Baudot-Murray code with enough reliability that it will produce readable traffic at the other end.
So was this Hellschreiber machine just for testing?
No, it's quite common in the German military. They don't tend to use it for in-cipher communications, as far as I can work out.
Right.
But it's used for field communication.
Okay.
And they've got plenty of these handy. One of the problems for the British is they don't use the Hellschreiber, so they have to build their own. So Ken Worthy has to put this program into effect of building sort of ersatz Hellschreibers to pick up the German traffic. But again, they've got an understanding. They've heard of this system. So once they've worked out the technical details, they can do that. So as the Germans are bringing the system up to an operational level, the British are listening in, working out how to intercept it. When it becomes operational, they keep going. From 1942, there's a dedicated Y station for fish traffic set up in Kent at a place called Knockholt. It's almost next door to Chevening, which is the Foreign Secretary's official residence near Sevenoaks. And eventually that covers 160 acres of land. And they have these enormous aerials to pick up these very faint signals that are as much as 300 metres across. So a vast operation there, employing by 1945 about 800 staff. And as we will see later on, when you're breaking traffic, your intercepts have to be perfect down to the letter. And picking up these very faint signals produced by technology you've never been able to look at and you don't fully understand, reliably enough to get not a single letter wrong in a message that might be 10,000 characters, is an incredible technical feat. And it underpins everything that goes on at Bletchley Park with fish traffic.
It's completely different to how Enigma was broken, isn't it? Because Enigma, we've got multiple Y stations that are kind of listening to the same signals. So if someone at base A misses a bit, then someone at base B might be able to fill in that blank of that bit of Morse.
They do a similar thing in that they try and pick up the same message from multiple aerials and sometimes multiple sites.
Oh, right. Okay.
And they have an outstation up in Scotland at a place called King Ask, just outside Cooper, which is wired into Knockholt all the way down in Kent. So it's like having an extra aerial all the way in Scotland to pick up the same transmission. And they have a couple of other smaller Y stations as well. And what they tend to do is they will pick up a signal on multiple aerials and then feed one into an undulator, one into a tape printing machine, one into an actual teleprinter, and take as many copies as possible in as many different formats as possible. And then you can combine them together again. One thing I've got on my computer is a flowchart in the process at Knockholt of forming a final agreed version of an intercept, which is, fingers crossed, as reliable as possible. And even when you go through that checking and rechecking process, something like half the signals they pick up can't be broken because they're too corrupt. So producing any traffic that's workable at Bletchley Park is, as I say, enormously impressive. And we have to remember that this work is going on outside Bletchley, and it underpins everything.
Well, this obviously leads us to the next question, which is, we're able to pick up these signals. What do GC and CS do to attack it?
Okay, so the problem first falls to a section called the research section, and it's a uniformed army section. It's been set up by John Tiltman, the chief cryptographer, and it's led by a man called Jerry Morgan, Captain Morgan, who I think we've referred to in the past.
We have, of rum fame.
Indeed. But actually, it's Tiltman who mucks in and performs some of the very early work on these messages that they're picking up. So they start off with intercepts. They know it's non-Morse. They understand it's probably a Vernon cipher produced by something like the Parker Hit Machine. So they've got this basic idea of how they might attack them. And initially, they're trying to exploit what they call depth. They're trying to attack messages that have been sent on the same cipher key, where the machine has had its wheels started from the same position. And it's very typical, again, very typical cryptographic technique of attacking depths. And they're able to spot some depths by exploiting a mistake the Germans are making, where they're including the same sort of phrases in the plain language radio chatter as in the encrypted section of the radio messages. So based on that principle, that if you add Bow.Murray text to itself, it cancels itself out, you can get messages which you think are in depth, and we'll explain how you know that in a little bit, and you add them together, and they know the result of that will be to cancel out the effect of the keystream and to leave you with something which is two plain text messages sort of mashed together. If you imagine it as an equation, you've got rid of the keystream on both sides of the equation. So you've got plain text plus plain text. And then what Tiltman does is add some of those procedural signals from the plain language to the enciphered part of the text, and he gets stuff that looks like German coming out. Phrases like Spruchnummer, message number. So he's able to prove that these are depths. He can't really exploit that any further because he doesn't know what else he's looking for. He doesn't know what the rest of the enciphered message looks like. He's only got fragments from the plain language traffic. But he's able to make some initial assumptions about what's going on. What he needed was two nice long messages in depth where he could guess the content. It takes a while for this to happen, but the Germans do eventually give him exactly what he needs.
Very kind of them.
You have this famous message sent on the Athens-Vienna link where the operator sends the full message and he types it out by hand, so it takes a while. And then the receiving operator says, I didn't quite get that. Can you send it again? And he grits his teeth and he does send it again. But the second time around, he doesn't send quite the same text because he abbreviates a lot of it. So instead of writing Spruchnummer, he writes SPNR, shortens it all. And because the meaning of the two messages is the same, even though the text itself is different, Tiltman is able to get his claws into it and starts to tease out these two plain text messages, one from the other. And when he has successfully guessed a section, he gets a little bit more plain text German from the other message, and he's able to see that they're the same message, and he's able to carry on the break, working from one message to the other, all the way through, sort of zigzagging through this text, until he gets to the end. He gets a stretch of decrypted message, which is as long as the shorter version. So that's a total of 3,976 characters. So a nice long bit of text. And also, what's really important is he's able to deduce from that text what the cipher key was, again, by working backwards, by reversing the calculation. So they get this nice long stretch of keystream produced by the Lorenz machine, and this is crucial. That goes over to the rest of the research team, and they spend, I think, a couple of months trying to analyse this piece of keystream, but they don't get very far until it comes down to Bill Tutte. It seems, as a sort of last resort, he's handed this and asked if he can make any progress with it. And the problem they've had is that their assumptions about the traffic were wrong. Their assumptions about the machine were wrong, because the hypothesis they were always testing was that there were, like the Parker Hit machine, two sets of wheels, which each right. moved with each letter of the message. And as David has explained, Lorenz doesn't work like that. In Lorenz, one of the sets of wheels doesn't move all the time. And that's the hypothesis which they hadn't tested. And it's what Tut is able to work out. What Tut does is he spends a very long time writing this key stream out on squared paper, impulse by impulse, writing lots of dots and crosses and trying to look for repeats. And what he's actually looking for is one wheel in particular. They know from the message indicators, which involve representing the wheel start positions by sending letters of the alphabet, essentially, yeah. that for one place in the indicator, they don't always use every letter of the alphabet. They only use 23 letters. So there can't be more than 23 positions of the wheel in that position. The other wheels, well, they could be much longer. They're not going to be thousands of positions, but they could be dozens more. So all that Tut is looking for is that 23 position wheel, because that's all the information he has to go on. But he doesn't find it. He actually spots the wheel, which repeats at 41 positions. He realizes if he writes out his text in rows of 41 positions, he starts to spot repetitions down the columns, which indicate there's something periodical going on every 41 letters. But it's not a perfect repetition. He's spotting fragments of repeats, but only fragments. So there's something else going on, something non-periodical, non-regular. And this is what's really impressive. I mean, this, quite a lot of the cryptography at Bletchley, this tends to be described only the first part of the process, with Bill Tut writing out all the stuff on square paper and spotting the repeats. But that's not the really impressive part of the process. That's only the beginning. What's really impressive is then he spots these repeats. He's able to work out what the counterpart wheel from the second set of wheels is, what we call the psi wheels. The first set of wheels are the chi wheels. The second set are known as the psi wheels. And Bill Tut comes up with this terminology. And the psi wheels are the ones that don't move every time. What he basically does, and this is why this is an amazing feat of cryptanalysis, is he basically, by trial and error, comes up with a way to make his 41 character repeats regular. But he's got many sections of 41 in his 3,000 odd characters or 4,000 odd characters. So he basically fiddles with this stream produced by the chi wheel until he gets a nice repeat and there aren't any contradictions anywhere along the series. And then, again, by similar process of deduction, if you take away that chi stream, that regular stream of impulses from the key stream, you are left with the psi stream. And so he doesn't break one wheel, he breaks two at the same time.
Yeah.
And one of those is non-periodical, and he spots this really strange behavior where there is a pattern there which repeats every 43 positions, but sometimes the pattern is extended where you will get a dot in more than one position or a cross in more than one position. But if you eliminate all those repeated impulses, you get a repetition again of 43 positions. So you've got a psi wheel with 43 positions, but it only moves some of the time and sometimes it stays still.
So that's how they find
that's
out.
That's how he breaks into it.
Yeah.
And it's incredible. It takes a few more months for the rest of the research section to muck in and work out what's going on with the rest of the wheels and also the rest of the chi wheels, the rest of the psi wheels, and also the motor wheels. But it all stems from Tut's initial break. What I was reading the other day about how they work out the motor wheels is really neat. If you have the psi stream, you know that whenever two successive psi impulses are different, the psi wheel must have moved. If the psi wheel impulses are the same, you don't know whether the wheel has moved and just produced another cross or another dot, or whether it stayed still. But you can tell whenever the symbol is different, the psi wheel must have moved. If the psi wheel has moved, therefore there must be a cross on the motor wheel. So you can fill in all the crosses on the motor wheel, and then what's really neat is that you can do this not with one psi wheel, but with all five of them. And you can get five sets of deduced crosses from the psi wheels. And they're all the same motor wheel. So you can fill in virtually all the crosses on the motor wheel by deduction from what the psi wheels are doing. And then you kind of fill in the dots everywhere else and you have the whole motor wheel pattern. This is the point. It's not that he just visualizes it because he's really smart. There's a hell of a lot of hard work that goes into this and absolute dogged persistence, and he has to be absolutely methodical and consistent in all his calculations, and he just kind of works it out, but it takes weeks of work. And so it's not just that he's smart, he's also a really hard worker. Yeah. He does something really difficult. That's what it comes down to.
So the job was passed to Bill Tut a 24-year-old graduate from Cambridge who had been offered to Bletchley, interviewed by Turing, and rejected by Turing. But he was taken on by somebody else, I think by Tilghman. Good job he did too. Bill Tutt managed, and it took him 2.5 months, managed to break Tunney. As it happened, I was working in the same office as Tutt, and I still have a clear mental picture of him staring into the middle distance for quite long periods, twiddling his pencil and covering reams of paper with counts. And I used to wonder whether he was getting anything done. My goodness, he was. The outstanding mental feat of last century. Not the war, last century.
The point to make about Lorenz compared to Colossus is that all the early breaking is by hand. Just like with Enigma, I've made this point with Enigma and the bomb before. The bomb helps you do it quicker. It doesn't start off Enigma breaking. No. Lorenz is exactly the same. They're doing this all by hand. And they're using similar techniques that are used initially by Tilghman and Tutt. They're getting depth messages. They're adding them together. They're teasing out the two plain text messages from each other. And as they read more traffic, they get a better idea of what plain text German on a Tunney link looks like. And they're able to do that teasing out process more effectively. It's quite well described by Peter Hilton, who's come over from Hut 8 by this point in the war to help out with it. He says, there's this enormous excitement in code breaking that what appears to be utter gibberish really makes sense if only you have the key. And I can do that sort of thing for 30 hours at a stretch and never feel tired. Incredible, isn't it? And he's talking about teasing out these depths. He says, you were tearing this apart to make the two pieces of text. And it's absolutely a marvelous process. You keep extending and going backwards as well. You break in different places and try to join up, but then you're not sure if top goes with top or bottom goes with bottom. The nature of Baldock Murray code and its binary nature is that sometimes you don't know if you spot a plain text German word, you're not sure if it goes with the top message or the bottom message.
Yeah,
it could be either way around. So you have to swap things around sometimes to work out what's going on. But Hilton continues, for me, the real excitement was this business of getting these two texts out of one sequence of gibberish. It was marvelous. I never met anything that was quite as exciting, especially since you knew that these were vital messages.
It's just the sheer excitement in his description, yeah. Isn't it? It's amazing.
So there are people there who really thrive in this atmosphere of doing this very menial work in many ways. There are others who are not really there by choice. So at one point, they are bringing in intelligence corps clerks to basically drag a crib through a message. And they try this word or phrase at every successive position and work out the result. And it's a sort of brute force approach, and then it all goes over to one of the cryptanalysts to work out whether they've found anything useful or not. Yeah. So that was obviously incredibly mind-numbing and not very enjoyable for the people involved, and they weren't being very well briefed on what they were doing. What they realise is that you actually have to roll back on the automation and the factory-style nature of the work, and you have to let the same person drag the crib as carries out the final decryption because it's more efficient that way.
How do they come up with these cribs? I mean, some are obvious, but do they have, you know, does someone sit there thinking up cribs?
Yeah, part of the skill of this code breaking is, again, like with Enigma, getting inside the mind of the German operator and thinking what they're going to say. And it's experience of the traffic. It's understanding of how these signals look. And it's the procedural bits. It's those letter shifts and figure shift bits and the bits where they're doing punctuation that they can exploit regularly, but also it's beneficial to be able to guess what the Germans are going to say to each other. So Peter Hilton, again, gives us a really good example of this. He's reading a message from southern Italy, and he works out one word in this message is murderisher. And he goes, what could be so murderous if you're stationed in southern Italy? He says, it's probably not the food. It's probably the heat.
Mm.
And he puts in hitze, which is heat, and gets out the next part of the complimentary message. So he's able to guess at what the Germans are complaining to each other about on their encrypted teleprinter link. And it's during this period of breaking by hand that things are reorganized and the task goes over from the military section to a new section, which becomes known as the testery. That's not because they do testing. It's because it's led by a man called Ralph Tester. And the testery's origins are really quite interesting because we tend to think about, at Bletchley, the mathematicians coming to the aid of the linguists. But in this case, the linguists come to the aid of the mathematicians because the research section is full of mathematicians, but they need people who understand more about the German language.
Right.
So they have a team, it seems, breaking German police traffic elsewhere in military section. And Tiltman or somebody else spots that there's some potential here and brings them in to work on Lorenz. And they're sometimes known as the linguistic section because they're employing linguistic methods as opposed to the mathematical ones of people like Tut that they started off with. And they form their own section from July 1942. That's when they're known as the Testery. Tester's an interesting figure. He's not really a cryptanalyst. He speaks German. He comes from a background as an accountant for Unilever. So he has some mathematical ability as well. But it's remarked on that he's not really that talented as a cryptanalyst. But he's a manager, and he knows how to manage and motivate people. And he's just like Eric Jones of Hut 3 in that regard. He's another of these figures that Bletchley Park needs to run a section. He's described as friendly but firm in his management.
Yes,
he's exactly what you need.
He was our own Betty Webb's first boss here at Bletchley Park.
I think because I put on my CV that I spoke German, I was sent up to London to an interview, which was actually in German. And after about half an hour or so, the intelligence officer who'd interviewed me said, right, here's the railway warrant. Go to Euston and get on a train for Bletchley. Well, Bletchley at that time meant absolutely nothing to me. I didn't know where it was or what its role was in the war. However, I soon found out, and it was to work with Major Ralph Tester, who was a very senior member of the Government Codes and Cipher School staff, and he had rooms actually in the mansion where we sat and registered the messages as they came in. And it was a fairly boring task, but a very important one, because it had to be done in such a way that the messages could be called for in either date order or subject order by the code breakers.
Donald Mickey, who works in the Numerary, after being in the Testery for a bit, he says Tester had the sense of purpose and personal humility of an outstanding leader. Can't say better than that. And there's also a man called Tom Colville, who's basically second in command, and he's the manager on the spot most days. Again, he's from a managerial background in an insurance company, so he's got actuarial ability and some knowledge of maths, but not really a crippy.
No.
And there's two really good examples in Tester and Colville of how managers are, by that point in the war in 1943, making a really, really important contribution to the way BP is working. There's also quite a good quote about Tester about his actions on the tennis court, because he was quite a sporty and dashing fellow. He seems to have had a certain allure amongst the female staff. Mickey again says, I recall his mesmeric impact on female spectators in the lunch break as he leapt demonic and glowing about the tennis court with an animality that I had only ever envisaged as radiating from the great god Pan. I wouldn't phrase it that way personally, but then I don't come from a similar background as Mickey to make such allusions, but he was a physical presence as well.
Yes, it would appear so.
And the other big figure who's important in this period, of course, is Alan Turing. Let's bring him in, because the mythology here is that he does computers, so he contributes to the creation of Colossus. He doesn't really directly, but he does make a really important contribution in this period of breaking by hand. He comes up with something called Turingery, or Turing's method, as it started off as. And this is in about July 1942 again, when the Testery is established, that he invents this method. He seems to come over from Hut 8 and spend a few days or weeks in the research section because he finds the problem interesting. And he comes up with a way to do wheel breaking based on a stretch of cipher key, which you've established by breaking along depth. And this is the first method that involves what we later refer to as deltering or differencing, where you add each letter of a message to the following letter. If you think about how you can add two depths together to strip out the cipher key, you can add cipher key to an encrypted message to restore the plain text. By the same logic of cancelling out, if you think about how the psi wheels, about half the time, don't move, therefore their influence on the encryption is the same in two successive positions of the message.
Right, yes.
If you add two successive letters, half the time, you'll eliminate the influence of the psi wheel. You'll remove the psi stream entirely. So Turing realizes that if you take a very long piece of squared paper, you have a deltered form of your key stream where each character is added to the next one. And you start with the first position and you assume that by performing that calculation, you've eliminated the psi wheel. So you've only got the chi wheel to deal with. Because you've already removed the plain text, you're left with, theoretically, just the effect of the chi wheels.
Mm.
So you fill that in and then you can say, well, I know there's a chi wheel which has 41 positions. So 41 positions on in my squared piece of paper. I'm going to fill in that character again. Fill them all in. at the period that you know the wheels turn at, all the way along your sheet of paper. And you make further guesses as to what the chi wheels are doing on the assumption the psi wheel has been removed from the equation, and you fill them in. And as you go on, you'll start to find contradictions. Your assumptions will start to contradict with one another because sometimes the psi wheel is having an effect.
Yeah.
And you tot up the number of times you get a contradiction, and if it's high enough, and it's quite a subjective process, it really is kind of feeling your way through it. But eventually you'll get to a point where, like, no, that assumption can't be correct. I must have assumed the psi was inactive when it was actually active. And eventually, you do that for long enough, you'll weed out all the disagreements and you'll end up with periodical, regular, non-contradicting chi wheel settings. And I don't know how long that would have taken, but it must have taken at least a few days to perform on those calculations and remove all the contradictions until you've got something that looks regular and that you're happy with. But what they find is that even though that's quite a subjective process, it's effective in finding the chi wheel patterns. And you can confirm you've got it right because then you work out from them what the psi wheels are doing and what the motor wheels are doing in a similar sort of way as performed his original analysis.
It seems an enormous amount of work of brain power to hopefully get somewhere close to something that might help you a little bit. I can't believe how they managed to carry on doing this.
It's not as futile as it sounds because they're not changing the keys as regularly as they do later on.
No, at this stage, no.
They change the wheel patterns monthly. I think the motor wheel patterns change more regularly, but if you have already broken the chi and the psi wheels, you can work out the motor wheels relatively easily. And the fact is, this is the period of the war where they're being most successful. And actually, what history tells us is it's the only period of the war when they can had an expectation that all the traffic they're intercepting could be read, theoretically. One of the histories says, the months July to October 1942 constitute the golden age of Tunney from the cipher breaker's point of view. In each of these months, the machine was quickly broken, and before the end of the first fortnight, current traffic was being read as fast as the machines could decode it.
And this is pre any machines?
This is pre-key finding machines. So the machines they're referring to are those decoding machines, what they refer to as British Tunney, the British Lorenz machine emulators. But all that key finding itself is done by hand. Unfortunately, that was all going to be disrupted in October 1942 because the system was finally, on the German side, was finally going to become fully operational.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.